ASAP Equal Initiative Chest Pain Wave 1 Seminar. As always, I'm your host, Dr. Jason Woods. First up, we're going to introduce Dr. Phil Levy, who is the co-lead for the Equal Chest Pain Initiative.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon to everybody. So our focus topic is risk stratification scores and shared decision-making. The first presenter is Simon Mailer. Simon is an associate professor of emergency medicine at Wake Forest Baptist Health in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He oversees clinical research for the Department of Emergency Medicine and holds a leadership position within Wake Forest School of Medicine, Critical Illness and Injury Recovery and Research Center.
After Dr. Mailer, we're going to have Dr. Eric Hess present. He is a professor of emergency medicine at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and he focuses on patient-centered shared decision-making in the acute care setting.
With that, we're going to jump in with both feet and get started. And the first question is going to go to Dr. Mailer, but certainly we hope Dr. Hess will chime in. Simon, what is the impact of care variability on the quality of chest pain care?
Thanks, Phil. Before I get started, I do have a few disclosures that I want to get through. I receive research funding from the NIH. I also receive research funding from some foundations and from industry. I'm an author for UpToDate, and I am the chief medical officer of a startup company called Empathic. So there are some staggering numbers when we start talking about chest pain. Every day when I work in the emergency department, just like I'm sure when you work in the emergency department, you see patients with chest pain. In fact, usually on my shifts, I'm seeing multiple patients with chest pain. And so across the country, every year we see over 8 million, 8 to 10 million visits. And the data shows that we admit over half of these patients, use a lot of resources. These patients are admitted or placed in an observation unit and get comprehensive testing. And that costs a lot of money. It costs an estimated $10 to $13 billion each year. The question is, do we get our money's worth? Well, it turns out that we do all this workup and we spend all this money, use all these resources, but less than 10% of the patients actually have the disease process of ACS that we're looking for. On the other hand, it's been estimated that we miss as many as 2 to 4% of cases of MI, of ACS that we actually miss and send home inappropriately. So there's obvious room for improvement here. And a lot of the issues here have to do with variability. Our providers have variability in their experience and their training. They have differences in terms of risk tolerance and that fear of, am I going to get sued or not? And many of our providers across the country are using just Gestalt to try to make risk stratification decisions, or using old and unreliable risk stratification tools that they may have picked up many years ago. And to sort of underscore this, actually, Jesse Pines did a study looking at some of this variability in care and actually had providers take a risk-taking scale. And what he found, which is not really terribly surprising, is that the providers that were most risk-averse had a higher admission rate than providers that were less risk-averse. So there's also big problems that we've seen in multiple studies that show that clinical gestalt just doesn't work very well. It's not very accurate. And most of the time when clinicians are using gestalt, they overestimate the patient's risk. Sometimes, though, we can underestimate risk, particularly when patients present atypically, and this is particularly can be a problem in women. And so I like this particular study by Rick Bode. It was a 458 chest pain patient study. And what he did is basically ask his providers, what's your gestalt? What, do you think this is probably ACS? Definitely ACS, probably not, or definitely not ACS. And when they said it was probably ACS, 77% of the time those patients did not have any major adverse cardiac events. No deaths, no MIs, no revascs. When they said it was definitely ACS, this is for sure ACS, 47%, about as good as a flip of a coin, actually had an adverse cardiac event. And when they said, absolutely, there's no way that this patient is having ACS, 9% of the time actually had ACS. They had an adverse cardiac event. So the gestalt just doesn't work very well. So what happens is we have this problem. If we don't have great tools to figure out how to risk stratify patients, we end up having massive over-triage where we crowd our emergency departments, crowd our inpatient and the observation units. We test everybody, which leads to radiation exposure. We test these really low-risk patients and get false positive and negative diagnostic tests. All this leads to increased cost, and it's not patient-centered. Patients don't want to have testing that they don't need. So we are, unfortunately, sometimes delivering low-quality and low-value care. So how do we get to optimal risk stratification? It has to do with limiting that variability for sure. And it's really, how do we have a system that identifies patients who are unlikely to benefit from hospitalization and testing and basically identify those patients for early discharge and really focus our hospitalizations, our observation unit evaluations, our stress testing on the patients that are at elevated risk and are more likely to benefit.
So, Simon, we talked a lot about this standardization, but how do you actually do this? How do you go ahead and standardize the way things go? I know sometimes I'll come to work and a 30-year-old will be signed out to me awaiting their second troponin, and I'm thinking, well, you know, I probably wouldn't have done the same for this patient, and there's definitely a lot of variability. So how do we streamline this and standardize it?
Right, that's a great question. So there's basically a lot of momentum in this space and that people asking that same question on a larger scale. So if you start talking about this white paper from the Commonwealth Fund of Hospital Quality Improvement, which says that we need to have greater uniformity in practice through evidence-based clinical pathways, which will improve our patients' outcomes. And the way that we've approached this at Wake Forest and many others have approached this is through decision aids and accelerated diagnostic protocols. And basically what a decision aid is just a tool that combines the data that we typically get when we are seeing a patient with chest pain, so their history, what kind of character of their chest pain, and you know, is it radiating, those kind of normal things that we ask the patient, their risk factors, so their past medical history, what does their EKG look like, and then adding into that some biomarker data, and we're talking about ACS here, so we're talking about troponin primarily. And these decision aids have then been rolled into things called accelerated diagnostic pathways, or some people will call them accelerated diagnostic protocol, which are typically a decision aid and the addition of serial troponin measurement to risk stratify. And what you're doing is exactly like this diagram. You're taking your larger chest pain population and you're trying to identify that subset that's low enough risk that they don't need any testing versus these other subsets that need to move along with further evaluation in some capacity. And Eric will cover the whole how you can engage the patient to help with some of this stratification after you've used one of these tools. So what's the ideal tool? Well, the ideal tool is something that, of course, you have to have safety. We talked about the margin of error being low here and the acceptable miss rate being somewhere around that 1%, usually below 1% is the magic number. And you want something that's not only safe, but it's actually going to reduce healthcare utilization as well. It's going to reduce admissions, particularly among those really low-risk patients, reduce length of stay, reduce unnecessary testing. And this is an important last point, is that there's some pathways that have been derived in other parts of the world, and they may work well in that type of health system. It's really important that we pay attention to whether or not something has been validated in the U.S. health system, because we have a different health system in the way that it operates, and we also have different standards in terms of what we're willing to accept in terms of a miss rate that can be different from other healthcare communities and places in the world. The tool that we use has to appeal to all of the relevant stakeholders. It has to appeal to the patient. I'm going to let Eric talk more about the patient-centered piece of this. It has to appeal to the stakeholder who wants to make sure that they can safely disposition this patient, that they're going to make the right choice. And then it needs to also meet the needs of the health system. And the health system wants to know if they can improve patient outcomes and reduce length of stay, improve those efficiencies. So there are a few different potential tools. There's TIMI, there's GRACE, there's ADAPT, which is the two-hour ADP, which is a TIMI-based rule. And then there's EDAX, Heart Score, and the Heart Pathway.
Simon, can you give us a little background on all of those scores and which ones you think are outdated or used inappropriately, and then which scores you think are worthwhile for us to continue using or continue investigating?
TIMI and GRACE are outdated tools. They were never really designed to be used in the emergency department setting. They were actually originally derived among patients that were having ACS, and then later they thought that this would be a really good idea to start applying this to ED patients. The problem is it's not sufficiently sensitive to identify patients that are low enough risk to be discharged from the ED. So even patients at a very low score for TIMI and GRACE still have too high of an adverse event rate for you to send them home. So we're not going to spend any time, really, additional time talking about TIMI and grades. So that leaves us with the DAP, EDEX, HART score, and pathway. My expertise and what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to talk a little bit about the HART score, and then I'm going to talk about our experience at Wake Forest with the HART pathway. So the HART score was originally derived and validated in the Netherlands by Barbara Backus and Jacob Six. And it's a decision aid that's designed to identify patients that could potentially be discharged without further evaluation like stress testing. And it's been validated now in well over 5,000 patients and has a over 98% negative predictive value and greater than 96% sensitivity for ACS. And it's an acronym based on history, EKG, AIDS, risk factors, and troponin, with each of those categories scored as a 2, 1, or 0, depending on whether it's a high concern down to slight concern or no concern. So if you have a total score, basically you just take each of those sections and you add them up, and if you have a total score of 0 to 3, that's a patient that's considered low risk by the HART score, and if they are 4 or greater, that's a patient that's considered at elevated risk. Some people will stratify this into an intermediate risk at 4 and 5, but for the purposes of this lecture, we can think of it kind of dichotomized because the patients at the 0 to 3 are the low-risk spectrum, whereas the ones at 4 or greater are identified for probably needing something further. This gets into that whole acceptable miss rate that we were talking about. The HART score, and they've had a couple of studies now that have shown this same number of 1.7% missed major adverse cardiac events, and they look out 6 weeks. And in many places, particularly in Europe, they find that to be an acceptable miss rate. However, we already talked about our acceptable miss rate not being that high and really trying to get below 1%. So we did the first validation of the HART score in the U.S. at Wake Forest. We looked at 1,000 observation unit patients. And this was a very low-risk cohort. This was back at the time when we would basically admit anyone with chest pain to either our observation unit or to our inpatient wards. What we found is if we used the HART score on these patients, we could have potentially discharged 84% of those patients. 84% of the patients we were keeping in the observation unit were low risk by the HART score. However, we would have missed 5 NSTEMIs using the HART score. And what we found is that all of those patients actually had positive serial troponins. And so we thought, wow, what if we created an accelerated diagnostic protocol using the HART score where we added 0 and 3-hour troponins to, instead of a HART score, we're really kind of adding it to a HEAR score. So regardless of what your score is, if you have an elevated troponin at 0 or 3 hours, you can't be classified as low risk. And we found that using it that way, we would have 100% sensitivity, and we still would have been able to classify 80% of our patients as able to be discharged from the observation unit. So we improved the sensitivity and negative predictive value compared to the HART score alone. Some other caveats here is that they also have to have no ischemic EKG changes, because we really don't care what their HEAR or HART score is if they've got acute EKG change with ST depression or new T-wave inversions that look real significant. That's not a patient that we want to discharge home. And also, we don't do an early discharge on patients with known coronary artery disease. So we validated the HART pathway first in a 1,000-patient data set. This was the MIDAS study, which was an 18 USED patient cohort. And it was a much higher risk cohort than the initial study, and we found that the HART pathway was over 99% sensitive for our acute coronary syndrome and could have decreased admissions in that cohort by a little over 20%. Now, following that, we did a randomized controlled trial where we randomized 282 patients at Wake Forest with equal probability to either receiving risk stratification with the HART pathway or usual care, and usual care was based on the ACC/AHA guidelines. What we found in that study was we dramatically increased the early discharge rate of our patients when the HART pathway was used compared to usual care. So this was a difference of 21% in absolute terms. In relative terms, we basically doubled the proportion of patients being discharged. And other important things that outcomes. We found that we decreased the length of stay, median length of stay, by 12 hours in our heart pathway group, and we saw a cost reduction of median of $216 per participant. So the important part of this from a safety standpoint was we were able to achieve all of those efficiency gains without having any adverse cardiac events among our low-risk participants. And there was no difference in the number of adverse events in the heart pathway arm compared to the usual care arm. The other thing that people always worry about is, am I going to use one of these tools? Am I use the heart pathway and this patient is just going to be back in the ED tomorrow complaining of their chest pain again because we didn't test them? Well, our data did not show that these patients were more likely to bounce back. In fact, none of our low-risk patients had a 30-day cardiac-related non-index hospitalization, so they didn't come back and get hospitalized, and they didn't actually even come back and come into the ED at all for any cardiac-related complaints. And there was no difference in these outcomes in our heart pathway versus usual care arms. So to summarize this data, basically the heart pathway reduces healthcare utilization outcomes. We've shown it to reduce stress testing, hospitalization, length of stay, and cost, and importantly, all these efficiency gains occur without increasing adverse events or incurring recurrent care.
Sometimes this is a hard question to get at, but do you think there are any benefits that you weren't able to measure or any hidden improvements in the system that we just don't have a metric to look at yet?
This is not necessarily something that we've measured in our study, but this is something that we hear frequently, is that the benefit is that we have everybody on the same page. By delivering standard care, there's decreased disagreements, there's better workflow, and there's better provider efficiency.
We're going to jump into shared decision-making, which is not a concept that is going to be unfamiliar to most people, but the research into it and how to use it and why to use it probably are. Dr. Eric Hess is an expert in this and has two PCORI grants on the shared decision-making process in the acute care center. Eric, how do we go about including patients and families in these decisions in a way that works for us in the ED as well?
You know, to answer your question, I think it's helpful to start with a case, and I will go ahead and mention that some of my work has been funded by Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, but fortunately, I did not get any of the money myself. The institution got all the money, so you can take that for what it's worth. So this is John. So John is a 55-year-old male, and, you know, actually, he works for a medical device company, and over the last several months, they've been losing market share, and he was in his office getting his quarterly report together, looking at those numbers and drinking coffee. And then he develops this sort of spontaneous left-sided chest pain while he's just sitting down in front of his computer. So he decides this worries him enough that even though his big quarterly report is due tomorrow, that really should get this checked out. The look from his colleague from the cubicle across the way worries him enough that he was strongly encouraged to be seen in the emergency department. And so he developed this pain approximately an hour prior to seeing you in the emergency department, and he describes it as a left-sided anterior discomfort. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't go into his jaw or into his arm. It doesn't go through to his back. When you ask him sort of the review of systems, he says, you know, I feel a little sweaty, but there's no objective diaphoresis. His forehead's not wet. He reports feeling a little short of breath, but he's sitting 100%, and he has no signs of increased work of breathing on exam. His lungs are clear. Just evaluating him a little bit further, his chest pain is not reproducible, and he really hasn't had a chance to exert himself since he started an hour ago. You ask him a little bit more about his cardiac history and his other histories. He's actually a fairly healthy guy, and he has a history of high blood pressure, for which he takes metoprolol, as well as high cholesterol. But he's never had any heart problems before. He's never had any heart procedures. And by the time you see him, the nurses and triage have already ordered an ECG, and you're looking at the ECG, and it shows a normal sinus rhythm. And you don't see any evidence of acute ischemic changes. His QRS and ST segments look normal. While you're evaluating him, he describes his chest pain as a 1 to 2 out of 10. And so further history, you recognize he has no risk factors for a pulmonary embolism. You know, the history doesn't strike you as suspicious for aortic dissection. He has no fever or cough, so you're not worried about a pneumonia. I mean, you're going to get a chest x-ray anyway, just to be complete, but you don't think it's a pneumonia. And all things being equal, he kind of falls into this category of like, well, I guess it could be your heart, but there's nothing to really hang your hat on. So he just falls into that possible acute coronary syndrome category. And so as you're thinking about John, I want you to think about what your approach might be to his evaluation. Presuming his first troponin comes back as negative, what would you say to him, and what would be your plan, and why?
All right, since we're going to put John away for a little bit, I do have a question. Are there any agreed upon definitions for what shared decision making is, or do you have a good way for us to conceptualize what it is?
I think of shared decision making, there's a lot of different definitions of it, but I think of it as involving the patient in making decisions to the extent that they desire to participate. And as a physician, we're the ones who are often like setting the stage and creating the conversation, and it's often, if we're assertive and we're busy, it's likely going to be a monologue that's mostly us and the patient either assenting or dissenting to our recommendations, or we choose to sit down beside them and ask them some questions about their life and what they're doing and what they're worried about at the moment in time, you can start to get a bigger picture of the individual that you're caring for. And once you start to know that individual and just giving them the opportunity to participate in decision-making, but if it's something that is not in their best interest at that moment in time, or if there's a cardiac arrest that rolls in while you're talking to him, there's other things that can impact the resources that we have to interact.
All right, well, let's bring John back into the mix. Can you actually walk us through what you would say to him or how you would start this conversation?
So I would start off talking with him about how anxious he and nervous he was about his upcoming quarterly report. When someone's that anxious, it's often difficult for them to really have a lot of cognitive freedom to really understand what's going on. So the first thing I would tell him is that, John, I know you're worried, and I can see how you're worried about both your chest pain and your upcoming quarterly report, but I've got good news for you so far. The blood test that we did, that we call a troponin, but it looks for heart damage, is negative. In your case, we're going to do another blood test in a few hours. If that's negative and this other pink tracing that we've already obtained, this electrocardiogram, we'll get another one of those. And if that's negative too, we can tell you with the confidence that you're not having a heart attack. And I would often intentionally just pause and just kind of let him think in and then say, you know, even though I can tell you with confidence you're not having a heart attack, we are not quite as good at telling you about your short-term risk for a heart attack with the degree of precision that we might be happy with. So our next couple of options would be whether or not we'd want to get a stress test or a picture of your heart called a coronary CT angiogram that tells us about the blood flow to your heart. And so those are some of the, provided that your next blood test is negative, those are some of the next tests to think about. And in your particular case, we can tell you that after your second troponin is negative, the highest risk you would have would be 1 in 100. And then I would say, all right, so given what we know of your risk, here's what our next options are. So we could either get a stress test or a coronary CT, one option. Another option would be to be seen by one of our heart doctors here within 3 days. We can help you make that appointment. Another option might be if you really feel comfortable with your own primary care doc and want to make that appointment for consideration of a stress test, then certainly welcome to do that. But if it's your preference, we'd still set you up with an appointment with our heart doctor just in case that falls through. And the last one is, I'm too nervous and this doesn't make as much sense to me, and just making me feel more comfortable, doc, if you made the decision. So as the emergency physician, you can either have a leash that's longer or shorter, depending on multiple factors that go into the decision-making process.
I know that you formed this conversation into a decision-making aid, and for those podcast listeners, you're not going to be able to see this, but I'll describe it to you. So it has some structured language and a pathway to step through for the physician and for the patient to help start the discussion. And then it's got a visual aid where you can actually depict for the patient what their risk is. And the way that they do that is with little stick figures, and what your risk is as far as percentage is how many of them are colored pink or red out of 100 that are a different color. Eric, we talked a little bit about your grants, and a large part of what I wanted to ask you about today was what the results of these trials were. So do you have any data on the usefulness of this decision-making aid?
So we sought to test how effective this decision aid was in a randomized trial compared to usual care. So how do we do that? We designed a randomized control trial in which we randomized patients in either into a usual care arm, in which the clinician was encouraged to engage with the patient in their according to the usual manner and their normal habits of interacting with patients, or to use of the decision aid to facilitate a more standardized discussion and provide the patient an opportunity to weigh in on the decision. We concealed allocation by a password-protected web-based tool that would randomize the patient at the time of enrollment. We dynamically randomized them, and that's just a fancy way of saying that based on the patient's age and sex and the site that they were enrolled, that the data set would just look back and determine how balanced the arms were at that moment in time, and then would randomize them to the arm that would be most appropriate given his age, sex, and site he was being enrolled from. And then we enrolled patients on a one-to-one basis into usual care or to the decision aid arm. So we conducted our study at 6 centers across the United States, and you can see how nicely spread out the sites are. And so we recruited patients from UC Davis in Sacramento, as well as from Rochester, Minnesota, and Indianapolis, 2 sites in Pennsylvania, and 1 site in Florida. So who do we enroll in the study? So we enrolled patients just like John, essentially. The initial workup was negative, and the clinician was considering them for admission for observation for stress testing or coronary CT. and we excluded patients with the high-risk characteristics. So when we were designing the study, we met with our patient representatives and the investigators and representative clinicians and actually a payer representative as well, and got their input as to what outcomes they would need to see to influence their decision-making. And sort of uniformly, our patients were actually most worried about being left in the dark and us getting too busy to tell them what's going on, because it would just increases their fear and anxiety, and they start imagining things that are worse than they often are. So we, for those reasons, prioritize patient knowledge as the primary outcome. We also measured the degree to which the patient was engaged in the decision-making process using a scale called an option scale. We asked about the acceptability of the decision aid from both the clinician and the patient. Finally, we assessed more traditional cardiovascular endpoints, such as the safety using the 30-day rate of major adverse cardiac events, as well as the amount of resources that were used in each arm of the study, including the rate of admission to the observation unit for stress testing or coronary CT, as well as the 30-day rate of stress testing. So what did we find? We enrolled over a year and a half, 971 patients, and you can see they're evenly distributed. And this is a table that is comparing some selected baseline characteristics between the two arms of the trial. And as you can see, there's no significant difference between the arms of the study based on these and other characteristics that aren't being shown. And the bottom line of this slide is that the randomization process worked. And so the arms of the trial were balanced with regard to these patient factors. And so if there's any difference in the end of the trial between the two groups, we can be fairly confident that it's due to the intervention and not some other factor. So here's our primary outcome, the one that the patients told us they wanted to know most about. We assessed knowledge by immediate survey after the emergency department visit and found that the patients who were randomized to the shared decision-making arm were more knowledgeable regarding their risk and their available management options, and they were significantly more engaged in the decision-making process by their clinician. When we asked the patient about their experiences with the shared decision-making process and the decision aid, that the patients who were in the intervention arm reported that what the clinician shared with them was of greater clarity, and they would recommend use of the decision aid or that type of experience to their friends and family. We asked the clinician similar questions, and clinicians said that when they used the decision aid, the clinicians found the information to be more helpful. They would recommend use of the decision aid to their colleagues, and they would want something similar to use for other emergency department decisions.
All right, so what about any adverse events? Can you tell us about that?
There were some myocardial infarctions. There were 7 patients in the intervention arm who were revascularized with PCI. There were no deaths, and there was 1 major adverse cardiac event. And I'll just highlight that in the 1 major adverse cardiac event in the intervention arm was a patient who decided with their physician to be admitted to the hospital and actually had a negative nuclear perfusion stress test and then returned to the emergency department within 2 weeks with recurrent ACS-type symptoms and had an end-STEMI by troponins.
What you're saying is that this was a patient who was admitted and had negative testing and then a recurrence. So we could safely say that this was not related to the decision instrument. I did want to ask how this specifically affected resource utilization. So did it change at all the amount of testing that was going on, the number of admissions, or the patients that were getting observed?
So how did this impact resource use? So it decreased the rate of observation unit admission by 15%, decreased stress testing within 30 days by 7%, and you can see a trend towards the lower rate of coronary CT, but the difference wasn't significant.
We're getting close to the end of our time here, so can you give us the one-liner summary of the study and what you took out of it?
Patients who were randomized to shared decision-making facilitated by the decision aid had greater knowledge, were more engaged in the decision-making process. They have a lower rate of admission to our observation unit for stress testing. This extended out to 30 days and had a lower rate of stress testing within 30 days. The providers reported that its use was acceptable. Greater proportion of patients who used the decision aid opted to follow up as an outpatient with their physician's input, and that there weren't any adverse events in the trial that were due to the intervention. So I'll transition into sort of another study that one of my colleagues conducted while we were working on the chest pain trial. And his question was, how does shared decision-making impact the patient's perception of the clinician's perceived concern and sensitivity, or compassion as a more simplified way of thinking about it? We assessed this using a survey at the time the patient was discharged from the emergency department. And when we compared patients who were not enrolled in our shared decision-making trials to patients who were enrolled in our decision-making trials, we found that this rating more than doubled. And so this is the proportion of ratings of our physicians given by our patients that were, quote, top box, end quote, so the highest rating possible. So our baseline rate in our emergency department general population is 33%. And then compare it in our standard care arm of our decision aid trial was 35%. And for the shared decision-making arms, this rating of provider compassion more than doubled. And as a patient's experience of care is starting to become a component of reimbursement, it's something that I think we're all going to be interested in figuring out how we can move the needle.
All right, we're going to sort of bring this home for the audience. So if you could design the ideal chest pain pathway that involved shared decision making, what would it look like?
So if a patient shows up with chest pain or possible ACS, then ECG is quickly obtained. If there's evidence of STEMI, that's treated appropriately and they're sent to the cath lab. If the answer is no and ACS is a consideration, then the next question is there evidence of ongoing active ischemia based on ECG findings initially, and combine that with the patient's presentation. And that's the case, we often would consult our cardiac intensive care unit for consideration of emergent cath, even though the patient doesn't meet objective STEMI criteria. But there's no evidence of ongoing ischemia, then we obtain an initial troponin. And then if that's positive, then that the patient falls into the ACS pathway and is admitted. And if it's negative, the patient is then risk stratified according to the heart score. If they're like John, he gets 1 point for his age. I thought he was moderately suspicious. He gets a point for that. And he had two risk factors, and so that gets him another point. So he's 3 points. He's technically low risk. According to this pathway, he would fall into risk communication and consideration of discharge with primary care follow-up.
And if I understand this right, if he fell into the moderate or high risk categories, that's when the shared decision making about further testing or observation occurs. Is there anything else that you want to leave us with today? Anything that you don't want us to forget to talk about?
One of the most recent changes on Medicare reimbursement is limited our observation charges to approximately $2,300. And we used to actually be able to obtain stress echoes and nuclear perfusion stress testing in our observation unit. But with that, just order one of those. It kind of breaks the bank. So for this particular pathway, if the patient meets criteria for exercise treadmill stress testing, then we can get that, because that's, depending on your site, you know, $200 to $300 charge, certainly feasible to get urgently. Otherwise, they can follow up with our cardiologist as an outpatient. And at least the sites in this study that we're planning have a really tightly integrated health system. So I think we can feasibly pull this off. But if that's not where you are, it's probably safest to, for the moderate to high risk patients, consider getting your cardiology colleagues involved and or admitting for a short stay if that's just not the setting you practice in. But that's an overview of engaging your patient in the decision making process. And with our patient John, he wants to get home. You know, he's held to the fire and he needs to have his quarterly report due tomorrow. And so after he rules out for 0 and 3 hour troponins, and we let him know if your risk is less than 1%, and clinically, I think I'm comfortable and I think you'll be safe, but you need to get it cared for. So take care of what's important on an urgent basis and then follow up with our heart doctors and we'll see what we can do to help you.
That's going
to
wrap it up for the ACEP Equal Chest Pain Wave 1 webinar. Thank you so much to Drs. Phil Levy, Simon Mailer, and Eric Hess for being with us today and presenting. As always, I'm your host, Dr. Jason Woods.